for this title. And he's got to go to Middlesbrough and get something. And I'll tell you, honestly, I will love it if we beat them. Love it.
Hello everybody, welcome to another edition of The Warm Down. Today I'm delighted to be joined by Oliver Kay, Chief Sports Writer for The Times, isn't it?
Chief Football Correspondent. We've got so many Chiefs, we've got to get the right titles.
Yeah. Does it mean anything, the Chief? Do you have like a big feather hat?
No, sadly not. Only for YMCA tribute acts, but no.
So Oliver, one of the top writers in the country, don't see you doing clickbait, don't see you doing big takedown articles. And we're going to get into this later. And actually, we're going to be giving one of these away. So we'll figure out after we finish this.
Yeah, sure.
How we're going to do that. But I wrote... I really want to talk about this now, but it's a downer. It's such a downer, isn't it? There's no positive things
well,
to come out
of this. I would argue that there's... I mean, it's a very sad story about Adrian Doughty, but I would say that there's probably a lot of lighter aspects to it in terms of the kind of personality he was and the talent he had and the way he sort of... adjusted to life after football, and even adjusted to life away from football when he was a footballer. So, I would say, and I would hope that people would find it uplifting in areas as well as sad. But
I'm going to leave it to the end.
Okay, that's fine.
For that reason. So there's several things I want to talk about. Mm-hmm. So back in September, I think it was, you interviewed Jose Mourinho.
Mm-hmm.
For me as a fan, Jose seems like he's putting on a sad face. Do you understand what I'm saying? Like, he almost seems like he comes out and has to, like, psych himself up and then get that miserable face on and approach the world. Because when you see him with the players, you know, when it's a little bit, you know, caught by accident, he's all smiles. And did you get that when you was with him?
Well, when I interviewed him, I think it was the 1st of September. The transfer window just closed and he was happy with the business that United had done, happy with the way they'd started and those couple of big wins at the start of the season. And he felt really optimistic, and he said at that time, I think he said, I don't like it when the sea is too calm, the sea is too still. I like it when there's a bit more, everything's very calm at the moment. I like it when it's, you know, there's a lot more tension, a lot more sort of intensity, a lot more friction around. And
I
always feel he thrives on that, but I'm sure he'd thrive on being a bit closer at the top. And I think it's probably a slightly difficult. I mean, you're suggesting he was putting on a sad face. I felt at times he's sort of putting on a brave face, because he's United are so far adrift of City at the top, and it's City and it's Pep and it's, you know, all of that kind of thing, and it's, you know, people questioning his philosophy against the wonderful Guardiola philosophy, and I imagine it's been quite galling, quite difficult for him. So it's interesting that we both sort of feel he's putting on a face,
he's
or putting on an act at the moment, act at certain times. But he's a guy who I don't think always wears his heart on his sleeve. I think you always feel that if he's saying something, there's a reason behind it. You know, for everything a reason. There's he doesn't ever seem to sort of say anything by accident or go into a press conference with a certain face on by accident or because it's heat at the moment. He always seems very much in control of what he's saying.
But saying that, though, actually, the thing that he said about the fans last week, when he said it was a bit quiet in here, that felt like an off-the-cuff, unprepared comment. It didn't feel... And it was twisted a little bit into a dig at the fans. I don't think it was.
But he said he said it several times now, and he's even said it in programme notes at one point. And I think he clearly has a bee in his bonnet about it, and he was the same at Chelsea. And I don't know whether he has got this vision in his mind or his perception of English football as being, you know, everything we as fans and media want it to be, which is, you know, fantastic atmospheres and so. But it isn't. You know, you go to, I mean, Old Trafford gets probably the toughest press in many ways because there's, you know, 75,000 there, and you know, it is quiet on a lot of occasions, particularly sort of Saturday 3 o'clock games. But
I think it also doesn't help where you guys sit in the press, you've got the away fans
next
to you.
It's definitely the case.
It's rocking where I am on Stretford End here too, but I bet you can't even hear a peep from us.
Well, you can hear it, but I mean, God, you know, I wasn't expecting to talk about the atmosphere, but the as I said, you go to Anfield, you go to Old Trafford, Stamford Bridge, the Emirates in particular, And everyone, the hype is all about this great atmosphere in English football. Yes, and it just isn't. It just isn't. And, you know, certain games are, you know, maybe sort of one game in five at Old Trafford, one game in five at Anfield. You know, the big European nights will be great, and they're starting again soon, and there'll be a real optimism around those. But the general Saturday 3 o'clock game, it's just flat, or 12:30 game in particular, it's just flat. And when you've got, I mean, we had a piece in the Times by Andy Kilduff, who's United fan, and you know, the Stretford and Flags. Yep. He was saying that, you know, this isn't for want of trying from the fans' point of view, but we go to the club and say, look, what can we do to improve the atmosphere? And he feels that they get resistance. And I think that's the case at most clubs. Clubs want the money. They want they want a different type of fan. The idea of the sort of noisy Stretford end, or the noisy Kop, or whatever, it's that seems to be something the club have actively discouraged by putting the most expensive, well, not the most expensive seat, but putting expensive seating in there. A lot of fans just spread all over the ground, and then, you know, United fans say, well, we want this singing section. And you think, well, right, well, that'll be right in the heart of the Stretford end, and it'll be, and it's in that far, well, to us, the far corner of the scoreboard end and the north stand. And it's, I always feel like, you know, you look over at that and you think, oh God, you know, it's, I mean, it's no criticism of the efforts of those who are involved in it, but you wouldn't know where it was. You wouldn't know what the singing section was if it wasn't the fact that there are a handful of, you know, banners there. And it's, I think, United, I think all the big clubs, and I've written about it a few times, but they have a duty to invest in that atmosphere and promote that atmosphere.
Surely there's a way to monetize.
Well,
that
exactly.
Atmosphere. Like,
exactly.
If you can sell it as the noisiest ground in the country, that's United like to say we're the biggest this, we're the best supported this. Mm. If you could say Stretford End's absolutely rocking, they rip the heart of it by putting the execs right in the centre of the bottom tier.
Yeah.
And then now they've the opposite end K stand, they've put in disabled right across the lower section. And when you speak to the disabled fans, they're like, we don't even want to be there. Like, people in wheelchairs with the camber of the pitch at Old Trafford are like, yep, can't see anything on the opposite side of the pitch.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And it's obviously no knock on disabled fans. Every right to be there like everybody else. But 300 disabled fans are taking the place of 2,800 fans that's in an area that's largely stood up. You can't tell me that's going to improve the atmosphere. Mm. It's not.
Mm.
And you think, with a bit of hindsight, they're talking about redeveloping the South Stand. You're like, the better hindsight, you could have put the disabled fans somewhere where they've got a good view, and you could have made K stand lower and the Stretford end lower, rail seats, safe standing. Because the reason away games is such a great atmosphere, and it's every away team, it's because you'll walk in and I'll walk in, I'll go, where are you? And you'll be like, I'm block P, and I'll be like, well, I'm T, let's come on mine, and we'll go and stand together. It's unallocated seating, even though it technically isn't.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I think that's what they need to return to, is unallocated seating. So you're not standing next to three people you don't know. You're with your mates.
Mm.
And I think that's going to have a massive improvement on it. But I don't see the club reversing the execs in the Stretford end.
No.
I don't see them reversing the decision, which has cost them hundreds of thousands, to put the disabled fans at the bottom of K stand. Unless they do rails behind them, which I can't see.
I'm fascinated by the safe standing argument. I mean, I think most people would agree, most fans would agree, if there's a standing section, that will improve atmosphere and so on. But a lot of the clubs say they want it or say they're in favour of it. But I would be surprised if United's public support of it is as sincerely held as I mean, what's in it for the Glazers, for Ed Woodward, for United? Do we think they really care about atmosphere, or do you think they care about maximising revenue from every seat? And to be honest, they could put the prices much higher than they are at Old Trafford. So I'm not going to say they bleed, you know, every fan as much as they can, but they want more executive seating.
Three times
more,
what it was.
Yeah,
but 20 years ago.
But the first few years of the Glazer takeover, they went up and up and up. And I remember I had a load of documents which showed how they were going to go up and up and up and up. It was, you know, we reported it on it in the Times, and it was a disgrace, really. But it was. But thankfully, they've steadied a bit. But over the last few years, and price is frozen. But it's largely because they don't really need that. You know, the sort of regular seats, they don't need to be anything like as expensive as they are. Never mind as expensive as they are at Arsenal or wherever.
Oh God, yeah, that would be crazy. I visited quite a lot of games on the continent last year. Yeah. Bilbao was a great atmosphere. Leipzig was a great atmosphere. We was in their ultra section, which is one entire stand behind the goal.
And as it should be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there was another one that I didn't go behind the goal. I went in the executive seats and there was £2. And that
was
CSK Sofia.
Oh, okay.
And it's the most terrifying game I've ever been to in my life. There was a police baton charge across the bottom five or six rows. Mm. And I was vlogging it, and I thought, I'm not going to pull my camera out and be like, hey, come and hit me with a camera.
Yeah.
There was flares, there was big TIFO banners. It was crazy. But I didn't think, well, you can't ever do that at Old Trafford, because for flares alone. But
no.
You think, it's such a cheap thing there, but it was so such an aggressive atmosphere.
Well, there's a balance, isn't there? You know, what do you want? Do you want that every time? Well, maybe sometimes some fans.
There's people climbing over the fence to try and get to the linesman after an offside that he didn't give.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, I think we as fans and as media sort of romanticised the bad old days in some ways, and
but attendances and, were shite.
Well, attendance. You know, the attendances of the 80s, and you know, Anfield and Old Trafford and Highbury and all these places, it was sort of 20,000-30,000 a lot of Saturdays, and that's despite the prices being so low. So I think, you know, the Premier League era, you know, when people say, oh, the Premier League killed football, Sky killed football, I think the Premier League and Sky and all that kind of thing invigorated football in a lot of ways, and I think there's an awful lot of good things, and safe stadiums and you know, more of a family atmosphere, all of that is good. But I think we've gone too far that way, and there should be more of that sort of rawness, more of that, you know, you should feel more fervour when you go into a ground.
You don't see young lads. I mean, as much as I'm probably too old for that, like, I want to see young lads having a balloon, 18, 19, 20 years old, just been drinking cans all morning, and I want to see them getting in there and having a barney, because there was a study, I think, you might have reported on it as well, actually, at the start of the Premier League. It was for the 25th anniversary of the Premier League, actually. So at the start of the Premier League, the average season ticket holder age was 23.
Yeah.
25 years later, it's like 41. So it's 18 years in, it's gone up in 25 years. It's essentially the same people.
So another 25 years.
Yeah, they're going to be in the 50s.
No, well, you go to, I remember going to Blackburn, and This was probably about 2000 or something like that. I'd just moved up to the Northwest again, and I was at Blackburn and in the press box there, and it was a very sort of grey-haired crowd, and that sort of surprised me a bit, because I felt like that wasn't normally the case at Premier League matches, but it is now. If you look in you look at the from the press box at Old Trafford, you look down and it's a lot of older people and you know, absolutely they have the right to keep their season tickets that they've always had.
But they're not going to balloon, are they? They're not going to generate atmosphere.
Well, no, and I think, you know, I think even people, I'll say my age, probably aren't going to be as sort of in the thick of the atmosphere and making a lot of noise like they probably used to. But it's I think there needs to be some kind of, I mean, clubs really need to think about what atmosphere is, how they can create it and how they can invest in it. And I think a lot of it is going to be about moving people.
People kick off.
Well,
I've sat here 20 years.
Yeah, or just create it. I mean, that singing section at Old Trafford, I don't think it is the right part of the ground. I think it should be sort of behind a goal rather than in a corner. But if you created that sort of singing section, and you if you created a sort of young people's section, and if it's not, I don't know. But I get the impression that if they did that, it would be for the young people they would target would be from, you know, other countries and from so on. And look, there's nothing wrong with fans coming from other countries. I think it's fantastic that there are the facilities to you know, come from Singapore or Hong Kong or wherever, and support United or support Chelsea, Liverpool, whoever. But I sometimes think that those fans are prioritised a bit too much by the clubs and for corporate reasons.
Yeah.
You know, I did a piece on it earlier in the season, and what it was someone at another club was telling me that basically, you know, all the sort of Thomas Cook travel packages, basically, you know, you can't get access to those tickets if you're a fan from Manchester, unless you want a night in a hotel as part of your ticket. And it's you know, there needs to be more of a, and it's not about United, but in general, there needs to be more of an investment in young local fans. And, and we've seen a lot of grounds, not Old Trafford over the last few years, but Old Trafford 15, 20 years ago, Anfield now, Tottenham obviously going to have a much bigger stadium, Chelsea going to have a much bigger stadium. And I think there was always a lot of hope when those capacities were increased that, oh, look, this is going to make more tickets, you know, more tickets for your regular fans, more tickets for young fans. And I don't think there's, you know, I think what has been prioritised in all of those cases is more corporate fans and more, you know, you see the thing at City now, the, what do they call it, the Tunnel Club, and obviously there needs to be corporate fans, and, you know, the corporate fans in some ways could be seen to subsidise ticket prices.
Absolutely, yeah.
But I think the balance isn't quite right in a lot of the grounds, and you only need to sit there in a ground. Well, I'll tell you what, if you sat there in a ground, covered your eyes and just listened on a Saturday afternoon, it would be hard to work out where you were, unless you knew where apart from the individual chants when they start. But a lot of the time, you could just feel like, oh, this is just another, you know. I think people often lump the kind of St Mary's, Riverside, you know, Stadium of Light, Britannia,
the
Meccano Stadium. But even the bigger club stadiums, a lot of the time it just feels, oh, you're just in one of those big stadiums which is overrun by corporate fans, and the atmosphere is not as it should be.
No, let's get back on Mourinho. That interview, he mentioned, he discussed with you the idea of short-termism and long-termism. And in your article, you sort of discussed, like, who was he talking about here?
Mm.
And I just want to explore that a little bit more, because on one hand, it feels like he was having a dig at Wenger.
Mm-hmm.
I also do think he was having a bit of a dig at Fergie for the dip that United have
gone through. I wondered that, and I wasn't entirely sure. And
what was his exact quote for everybody, actually?
I can't remember, but it was something along the lines of, you know, short-termism can be being at a club for 20 years and then leaving it, and it's not in a state to compete. Now,
yeah, that was it, because he was saying that he leaves clubs and they go on to things after.
Yeah, and you know, Real Madrid, I think, was the example that he used, where he did, you know, he won a title at Real Madrid, but he felt like a lot of the changes he made at Real Madrid were what helped them win the Champions League, three of the last 4 years. But it's interesting. I mean, I think he was having a pop at Fergie? I just couldn't tell, really. I do think he was having a pop at Wenger. And I think, you know, there is some sense in what he was saying, in that you could be there 3 years, you could win one league title, two league titles, and you could be accused of being short-term, but you could actually leave the club in a long-term, healthier state than... I mean, you look at Arsenal now, I think everybody's saying, well, it needs a complete rebuild. It doesn't just need a smooth transition from Wenger. It's going to need another Arsene Wenger, you know, what Arsene Wenger did in 1996. So I think there's some sense in that. I mean, I don't think anyone would ever accuse Mourinho of letting the grass grow under his feet at a club, or letting things sort of fall into slow decline. But I think, you know, what's often happened with Mourinho at clubs is that he's been there 2 years, and it's been sort of like, you know, scorched earth policy. It's been so kind of like a fire, like a hurricane raging through the club, and it's great for 2 years, and then it tails off. That has been the perception. There's no evidence yet to dispute that. I mean, by the time he left Chelsea both times, things had really kind of gone downhill with him and the players, and Real Madrid was certainly the case. Porto and Inter, he left on a real high, you know, incredible highs, and that was because he got out too soon. But I think in the United case, I don't think he's going to satisfy all his ambitions in the first 2 years. So we're going to find out what a third season of Mourinho at United is like. Will we get to find fourth season, fifth season? Who knows? Because I you know, he's just signed a long, you know, a new longer term contract.
He's only added a year on it, though, hasn't he?
Yeah, yeah, but it's
because when you read it, at first, like, oh, extension, oh, 12 month.
Yeah, yeah, but it's, I don't know. What's it? So what? It's to 2021. Is that right? 2021 in theory. Okay.
Where are we now?
2018.
He signed a 3-year deal.
3 year,
and then he's added a year on it.
So it's only to 2020. But yeah, I think there's an option for another for an extra year after that.
So
but it's, you know, people will look at that and say, well, will he be there in that time? Because the signings he's made have been quite, I don't want to say short term, but they've been more short term than perhaps some of those made by the guy over the road who you will probably want to draw some comparison with the media coverage of.
I believe, oh, absolutely. Definitely. Even this morning there was some. In fact, no, it wasn't this morning. Tottenham was the...
No, it was funny. It was funny because you said, oh, having Oliver Kay on and on Twitter, and what you know, any questions? And I think the first one was, why is he such a CEO? which, you know,
I wouldn't have you on if that was the case.
I could, by all means, try and explain that, but it wouldn't be so interesting. No, but a few of the people said, well, why the disparity in coverage, media coverage?
You've not, because I've got an article from you talking that Guardiola should play the youth and doesn't.
Yeah.
So I've got a balanced view of what you've wrote. I read the stuff you've wrote and I go, sound, I don't always agree, but...
Well, I think he's played the youth a bit, you know, League Cup games, and he's quite often now having Foden on the bench, and Zinchenko, who's obviously not, you know, he's not from Withenshaw, is he?
But I think that's what pissed people off last week, was people saying, here's evidence that he plays. Yeah. Like, hang on, but this guy was an international, well, he's played 50 games elsewhere, he's 21, like, he's not a youth. It's the apologists for him, people see their ass.
No, well, I'm glad if you think that my coverage has been balanced of Guardiola, because I've given him an awful lot of praise, and
a lot of
people interpret a lot of praise as being misplaced.
No, he does deserve praise.
He deserves enormous praise. I think the job he's doing there is absolutely brilliant. It's not just the results. It's the performances. It's the sense that, you know, City for the last, you know, they won the league in 2012, again in 2014.
Drew
it wasn't
it.
A sense, but there was never the sense that, you know, they were really creating something special. It feels now like they are creating something special. And I've praised him, I think, more this season than I've praised probably any other manager over the last 5 years. And people struggle with that. People say, oh, well, what do you expect? He's got, you know, he spent £120 million on fullbacks. As if, I mean, that the way that is trotted out, or what do you expect him to do at Barcelona? Because he had Messi. If you look at what he has done, wherever he's been, he's done it in such an unconventional, unorthodox way. In a way, at a time when I think a lot of other managers, and I include Mourinho and include Benitez and Ancelotti and people like that, they were all going, even Fergie towards the end, was going in a more sort of orthodox, conservative style of play, and he has gone with a kind of chaotic, counterintuitive a way of playing that goes against everything everybody else was doing at the time, and it creates teams that, I mean, they're on course for 111 goals and 100 odd points, and yes, they've got a very expensive fullback, Kyle Walker. Yes, they've got another very expensive fullback who's been injured since September, and you know, they spend a lot on central defenders. But generally, and he inherited some really good players. You
I think
know,
he inherited
Silva,
the core of his team, if we're being honest.
But
De Bruyne and Aguero.
But then Silva. You see where the coaching comes in, because you know, people say, a lot of City fans will say, "Oh, Silva, why has he never won Player of the Year?" And he's never dominated. He's never been as dominant in this team as he is now, or as De Bruyne is now. Aguero has added things to his game that weren't there before. Sterling just seems to have gone on, you know, like that. And
Sterling's a £50 million player. Yeah, it wasn't like a rough diamond he picked up playing in.
No. Well, but he'd gone there under Pellegrini the season before and had a fairly fitful season. Didn't look up to his Liverpool standard, but now under Guardiola, I mean, he's gone sort of skyrocketed. And yet, I think if you get a lot of United fans composing their combined team of City United, I think a lot of them would have. I would have De Gea, and that's despite Edison being amazing this season. People would say I'll have Valencia over Walker. People would say I'd have Bailly over Otamendi or Matic over Fernandinho. People would say I think a lot of people would make sure they found room for Pogba and Martial and in a combined team. So if those United team players are so good and City's players are kind of just good but they've got big price tags, how do you explain the disparity? Because I think Guardiola, I think you see individual and collective improvement in City that is, it's harsh to put it against United because United are second and they're doing well, but I think what you see is a difference in coaching where he's just getting so much more out of every player. And it's not just, I mean, you could say yes, they've got expensive players, but that extremely expensive team currently looks like the sum of its expensive parts, and maybe even more so. And I think that's probably going to be really galling.
If you try and analyse both sides, and you say the victory this weekend for City was De Bruyne and Aguero, mm-hmm. so they weren't signings mm-hmm. of Guardiola. Mm-hmm. They've got a more settled core, and I think that's a really important thing. I think mm-hmm. some of the signings prior to Guardiola coming were because Guardiola was coming.
Yeah,
I just think that.
Yeah.
And obviously he's got these players that have been there and settled in for a few years, and the likes of Kompany, and I think he's one of the only players that City have had over the years that I absolutely am jealous of. I think he's fantastic. I believe he leads the analysis sessions, which I think marks him down as a potential manager in the future. But when you look at the overhaul that had to happen with Mourinho, you look at people talk about the money spent by both clubs. I mean, it's irrelevant now. I think it's absolutely crazy. But when you say from that 2013 side, United have essentially got De Gea and Valencia that has left over that are first choice. City have still got that core. They've still got all of those players that are still having a big contribution. And I think because Pep's now, I think he's in 19 signings deep in 18 months, something along those lines. And Mourinho, hardly a pauper, but I think he looks over the road with jealous eyes. I think he's like, he signed 20 players. I've only signed 7, and one of them's going to America now. So you think...
But you know, Mourinho had the opportunity to spend his budget however he wanted, and he always wants sort of to build the spine.
I'm getting is he's asked for another window, which I believe will be the summer window, where we get ready-made signings, and then he's prepared to go with the Sessegnos or the Turneys or something like that.
Yeah, which is interesting. I mean, Laporte is City's most expensive signing. What was it, 57 million, which is, you know, which is what United were spending on Di Maria 3 years ago, and what they, you know, 75 million plus bits on Lukaku and 90 million on Pogba. City have, they've taken a view that they don't need to go top end of the market. They need to, I mean, maybe that is simply because they've got De Bruyne, Silva, Aguero, but it's not like, you know, they went for Leroy Sané when other clubs were kind of thinking, oh, well, he might be one to go for, look at in the future. Gabriel Jesus. City basically had a clear run at most of these guys, certainly from the Premier League clubs. That, you know, they weren't facing competition from United and Liverpool, Chelsea, Arsenal for these players. So I think, as well as what he inherited at City, as well as the work he's done at City, I think you've also got to look at there is... behind the scenes, there is a far greater, far superior sort of air of strategy behind the scenes.
This is a director of football, though.
Yeah.
Which we desperately need.
United desperately need. Really desperately. I mean, it's between Mourinho, and Woodward, there's nothing, which means you might as well say between, you know, upwards of Mourinho, there is no football knowledge in the club. Because, you know, they have this football club board which has got Bobby Charlton and Sir Alex Ferguson, and it's an irrelevance. It has no power whatsoever. And you know, it had a bit of input back in 2013, and that didn't go terribly well with the appointment of David Moyes. But the United is a club which really, I mean, I think everything they've done since appointing Moyes, everything's just been reactive. And I even think the appointment of Mourinho, although
opportunistic, not planned.
If you look at the way City went after Guardiola, not just for the final months of his contract at Bayern, but you know, they tried to get him in 2012. He went to Bayern in 2013, and they were all over him just constantly. Now you can say, well, is that ethically right? No, you can say, but essentially, you know, appointing two executives from Barcelona was with a view to appointing him and identifying him as the guy who would drive that philosophy. Now,
you have to admire the planning
and you have to admire, you know, the City's scouting system is widely recognised now as being massively better than most clubs, you know, in terms of the depth of information knowledge that they've got in all areas and you can say, well, how much scouting does it take to pick up Kyle Walker for 45 million, whatever, Raheem Sterling for 50 million? But they were, you know, City were the only ones who were saying 3 years ago that, right, De Bruyne, we know we failed at Chelsea, but we've done all our checks, we've watched him intently, you know, we're going to go for him, we're going to go for Sané, we're going to go for Jesus. I think rather than United fans seeing that as an implied criticism of their club, they should probably look at their club and look at the lack of knowledge.
I think it's a valid criticism
from the owners downwards and above Mourinho. And Mourinho will look short term inevitably because, I mean, he's got to win. He's got to win things at United and
probably Louis van Gaal after winning an FA Cup.
Yeah, yeah, and Moyes after winning a Charity Shield. No. So United really need those figures, and what I would wonder is whether if United would you trust this United board to pick the right man to be their sort of strategist? I'm not sure I would, but then if they did get the right man, would Mourinho be willing to work with him and see him not as a threat as he's seen directors of football in the past, but as somebody to
it almost needs to be a Mourinho appointment.
Well, it wouldn't be the worst idea, no. I mean, it would be, yeah. I mean,
if he sees him working for him,
yeah,
that's a good thing. But a director of football needs to come in and meet one day when he needs to pull a list together of replacements for Mourinho.
Yeah,
even
yeah.
if he's employed by Mourinho.
Absolutely.
Because the clock's ticking.
Yeah.
He's not going to get a golden clock here. Mm. We all know this.
No.
If he does 5 years, I think that'd be the longest he's ever done at a club. And people will go, oh, fair play.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think the pressure that's on United, the pressure that's on in the Premier League, the pressure that's on because of what's happening over the road, I think all that plays into this. And ultimately, if United aren't looking for somebody, if we've not got a list in Ed Woodward's drawer now of 4 or 5 people to even speak to, I mean, I don't know how I feel on it, but I'm pretty sure Pochettino's on that list.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure the meetings he's had with Fergie are no coincidence.
No, I do hear a lot of whispers of them liking Pochettino, and they're right to like him. The work he's done at Spurs has been, you know, very high quality, and people will turn around and say, well, he's never won anything. And I think it's a valid criticism, but I think it needs to be balanced with the valid observation that Spurs are sort of fifth favourites for every competition they go. Well, every time they go for a domestic competition, if they're in the Champions League, they're probably 10th favourites.
Do you think a lot of United's, I just wanted to look back on that, actually. Do you think a lot of United's signings are commercially thought?
Yes, definitely. Absolutely, undoubtedly.
City can go for the second tier player.
City can look at just what a player brings technically.
Yeah.
And whether they'll fit into that. I wrote a column about 2 years ago, and it was with relation to Pogba. No, it must have been last season. It was with relation to Pogba and how so much of the attention of what he has done has been kind of commercial, and it was, I find the pressure, the commercial pressure on Pogba is just slightly bizarre, really. But it's, you know, if you go back to how unhealthy Ferguson felt all of that side of things was, the commercial side, you know, the idea of Rooney or Beckham or whoever, or even Ronaldo, filming a commercial on an afternoon off, and you know, he just hated all that. Now, did United need to modernise? Does modernising help them, you know, increase their global revenues and so on? Yes, undoubtedly it does. But do they need to modernise? Yes. Have they gone miles too far? Yes, undoubtedly. Because I was told that United had talks with, a player. No, but I'm going to name him. Aubameyang, right? 2 years ago, late Van Gaal era, that United and other clubs were speaking to him, and he was being offered, and then he was being touted around everywhere, and his agent was having talks with various clubs, and he'd spoken to City and others, and I can't remember whether
rumored with a lot of moves on Barcelona and everywhere, Madrid,
yeah, but I can't remember if it was Barcelona or Madrid, but also City. I think Chelsea, and those clubs, it had always apparently been very, look, you'll be sent forward, this is how we'll play, da, 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 da. And at United, it was apparently, the presentation to him almost was entirely commercial. And it was like, you know, look what this has done for, you know, Daily Blint's, commercial pro, it's, and it, that kind of thing, and you hear it when Ed Woodward's speaking to the investors on the New York Stock Exchange, which just winds me up even saying that. But it's that sort of thing is just so over prioritised at United, for a club which I think was one of the last Premier League clubs to have Twitter, because Fergie thought it, they'll never catch on. United, they're just so driven by that, and yet you know that there's a sort of generation of fans who will just they just buy into, you know, the daft tweets, the Instagram stuff.
When we released that last week in the New York Stock Exchange thing, that we had more engagements on Twitter with the announcement of Sanchez than X, Y, and Z.
PSG with Neymar.
Who gives a shit?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm not arsed.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm absolutely delighted we've got a top level Premier League footballer.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
That'll do for me.
No. Well, I
thought the announcement was pretty cool.
Yeah.
But I don't lose any sleep over how many retweets it gets or anything like that. No. It doesn't.
Well, God knows what my most retweeted thing I've ever said is, but I doubt it was the best thing I've ever said on Twitter. it probably means I said something terrible, but
I get that.
But United are in a not quite uniquely powerful position, because Real Madrid are similar, but United are in an incredibly powerful position. I think what United are doing in order to capitalise on that position is helping the business more than it's helping the team. Pogba is an example of a player who I think he's a fantastically gifted player, but I think the reason why they were prepared to go to 90 million for him was because
it's Pogba.
Because the board were convinced and had worked out commercially, this pays for itself because he's a superstar. Would they have gone the same for? Would they have paid 60 million for De Bruyne?
Yeah, or Tommy Cruz, or someone who would have made the midfield tick just as much.
Can I say? Yeah, because I think Pogba is a fantastically gifted player. I think he was a miles better player at Juventus in a midfield which was set up very well. It had been built over time to get the most out of him and the most out of Pirlo and Marchisio and Vidal, and you saw one game, second half against Everton this season away.
Played in the actual
where
position.
That was the Juventus position where it was almost like a kind of free roll, sort of inside, sort of deep lying inside left roll, and it worked really, really well. And that has been one of the few occasions where I felt against anything more than modest opposition, where I felt Pogba's really shown
what he's capable of. The data doesn't back up that he was better at Juventus. He's improved last year, and then he's gone.
But in what sense? What assists?
No, chance creation, passes, key passes.
But watching, I mean, look.
I know
but
you mean.
Watching him, I don't think you'd pay £90 million for the player he's been at United. Except that you probably would in terms of the, you know, the hyperinflation in the transfer market. So you say, well, I don't think he has looked like the best midfielder in the world at United. I really don't. Or the best midfielder in the Premier League. I know people will say, well, look at his stats. Look at, you know, he missed two-thirds of the season. Well, missed two-thirds. He missed sort of September, October, with injury and suspension, and that didn't help. But the quality of what he's producing doesn't begin to match the quality of what De Bruyne or Silva or Eriksen or, you know, different players, slightly more, you know, slightly more advanced players. But this is what I'm saying. Pogba needs to be liberated. And I think they made the mistake in thinking when they bought Pogba, this guy is just going to dominate our midfield on his own. And they had, who do they have? Carrick, Fellaini, Herrera,
I don't know why Herrera, Matic and Pogba hasn't worked.
Yeah,
I mean, it hasn't.
But it should work.
Because last year, our best performances was with Carrick in the six, Herrera and Pogba.
Yeah.
And, you know, there were so many games that we, the Spurs and Arsenal games at home, the Arsenal one where they ended up getting a late equaliser, but that's that Spurs and Arsenal game, we bullied that midfield.
Mm-hmm.
And it was because those three played in midfield. And you think, if you just put Matic in for Carrick, I'll carry on normal jogging, and you're like, that should work, right? And no,
well, it should, but Matic isn't going to replicate what Carrick. I mean,
no, it's a different player.
Matic brings things that Carrick doesn't, but Carrick brings a lot in terms of continuity and vision and so on that Matic can't really match up. But you know, as I said, I think there was a feeling that that Pogba would just transform the midfield, and then. Once it didn't really work the first season, there was a feeling that, right, well, with Matic alongside him, he's going to tear it up completely. And there are fans who will say he has done, but you know, I think he's done on occasions and is not yet dominant enough. But I think what it needs is a third midfielder. So you're basically sort of signing a guy for 90 million, signing then a guy for 45 million who can help him work, and then signing another guy probably. You know, I don't know who it'll be, but you know, if you got a sort of Thiago type or a, you know, just that kind of guy who's box to box but with the ball is wonderful. And
Cruz
and
is the one I think yeah, but
Cruz plays a lot deeper and you know, but you know, I think United need. I think they felt they were getting so much with Pogba in the all round midfielder, and he is an all round midfielder, but he's not. He's not an all-round midfielder. Well, he can do everything, in theory.
But you get the best out of him in that final third.
Yeah.
The magic.
Yeah.
Let's get onto the book. So, Adrian Doherty.
Mm-hmm.
I have to admit, I didn't even know who he was prior to seeing the book. Why? Why Adrian?
Well, I'd always felt like I wanted to write a book, you know, obviously a football book, because I couldn't begin to write anything else. And I just thought it was something I would do kind of, you know, when I was a bit older and when I'd grown up. One day I was researching a piece, and it was 2011. It was coming up to Ryan Giggs's, the 20th anniversary of his debut. And I was speaking to, players who had played in the youth team with him, which doesn't mean, you know, the Beckham, Neville, it was the guys who were playing in the youth team with him in 89, 90. Because he was, you know, he was playing in the youth team at 16 and was a year ahead of those guys anyway. And I was saying to people, so the first time you saw Giggs, did he just stick out a mile in that team? And Alan Tong, who you mentioned, who was a fullback who didn't make it at United, got injured and went to Exeter. But he said, oh, do you know about Adrian Doherty? And I said. And I did know the name because I'm just a sort of nerd, and I knew the names of Alan Tong and you know, Wayne Bullimore and other people from that sort of reserve team of that generation. It's knowing the names of players now that's the problem. But the but So I did name know the name, Adrian Doherty, yeah. But I had no idea what had happened. And he said, well, look, he was incredible. He was as good as gigs at 16, 17. And he got injured and never recovered, drifted out of football, and he died in an accident in Holland. And I just immediately thought, oh my God, how do I not know this? What kind of story is there behind that? What you know, why hasn't this been written? I looked him up on the internet, and there was, you know, you look him up now, and there's loads through the book and so on. But you looked him up then, and that was only 2011, and there was basically one thing that was a tribute page done by one of his former coaches in Northern Ireland, which had, you know, testimonies to how good he was, and it had two sort of old newspaper clippings, one for the Manchester Evening News from early 1990, saying, you know, this 16-year-old wonder kid talked about as being the best thing since George Best is on the verge of his debut.
Curse for everyone who comes from Northern Ireland.
Yeah,
they get
absolutely
linked to nobody else.
Keith Glaspie he was on the verge of making his first team debut at 16. Would have been the youngest outfield debutant, or the youngest United debutant, I think, youngest outfield United debutant since Duncan Edwards, he would have been. And there was a game at Southampton late in the season, that 89-90 season, which was sort of such a grim struggle from United's point of view. And Danny Wallace unexpectedly passed the fitness test, and he didn't make the team or didn't make the bench that day, but end of that season he was offered a 5-year contract, and everyone was saying, look, wow, you know, this guy's going to be amazing. And the other clipping that there was from 2000, June 2000, 10 years later, saying that, you know, he died in this accident in a canal in The Hague in Holland. And I just thought, oh my, what on earth happened in that 10-year period? Why don't I know this? Why didn't I know that this kid who was rated as highly as Giggs at 16, 17, why didn't I know that he died? Why don't I know anything about it? So it just set me off on a. I mean, it was initially going to be an article for the Times, but I went over to meet his family in Strabane in County Tyrone in Northern Ireland, and they were saying, look, thanks for coming, but we don't want the publicity, we don't want anything in the papers. We're still grieving. This was 11 years on, but they just sat and talked to me, and we had endless cups of tea and cake, and they were just talking about not only his talent as a footballer, but the kind of guy he was, and that he was this sort of bohemian footballer that used to, you know, turn up at the Cliff, the training ground, with his guitar, and he'd be playing Bob Dylan sitting in the corner, and Saturday afternoons he would give his tickets away to watch the first team. They'd get two complimentary tickets each, the apprentices, and he'd give his away, and he'd go into get the bus into town, and that was the thing that I couldn't believe. Go busking instead.
Can you imagine who's on the verge of the first team?
Angel Gomez.
Gomez or Tuan Zebe now just like busking in town.
You can't really, can you?
It doesn't.
Well, if they were, it would be all over Instagram, and yeah. it would be a sort of cynical marketing ploy. But whereas that, it was just something he did away from football, I just became completely obsessed with it, and I went away from that meeting thinking, right, I know you don't want something in the paper. I respect that because you give me your time, but what I really want to do is write this book, because and the more and more people I spoke to, and I spoke to Giggs, and Giggs was just saying, look, he was just unbelievable. He was definitely the same level as me. He was definitely
and both-footed as well.
Yeah, two-footed, and as fast and courageous. And he said he was just, his decision making was so much better than Giggs's at 16, 17. But he was a sort of unorthodox, eccentric personality. Whether he was cut out for a career in football, even without the injury, I'm less sure. And it's not an attempt to romanticise him in terms of saying, look, this guy would have had the career Ryan Giggs would have had, because A, nobody does, but B, I think the unique or sort of eccentric nature of his personality was such that if he had made his debut, and he was so close to it when he got injured in February 91, he would have played in the first team. I think by all accounts, Gary Neville and others back this up, that he would have easily adjusted to the quality and the level as a footballer. But whether he would have really wanted to stick out a career in professional football, even at United, and with all the attention, with all the adulation that would be thrown at him, I think he would have been a guy who would have played, who knows, maybe 5 times, 10 times, 50 times, 100 times at United, and then even if he was outshining Giggs on the opposite wing, even if he was keeping Andrej Kaczmarskis out of the team, I think he'd just have walked away at some point because he was such an unusual guy in the way he viewed football.
But when I first heard that story and I heard that he was more into his music and this, and then you get the idea that this is a guy that almost doesn't like football, but there was something in one of the early chapters that I can't remember what it is now, and then there's these two pictures here where he's up against Richard Edgell. Look at the smile on his face. Isn't a guy that's playing football against his will.
No. I think by that stage, I think he was. I mean, that was 2 years after the injury. That was 1993, and he was kind of. I think he was struggling to get back from the injury, but he was. He played sort of for the love of it, and when he went to United at 16, he found it a real culture shock because it was suddenly very serious, and you know. You'd be playing for Eric Harrison and Nobby Styles, and they'd be kind of on your back and you know do everything properly. And by all accounts, he did do everything properly and did everything the right way and always the right decisions on the ball, and was you know raw in terms of his ability because he was that kind of. I mean, he'd not really had professional coaching until he went to United at 16, but he didn't really enjoy the kind of regimental style of things. He didn't enjoy the kind of dressing room atmosphere at Old Trafford.
Not being a jock, for want of a better word, some of the rest of the team.
Yeah, and he wasn't. You know, he was. I mean, he was a. I'm not making out. He's a shrinking violet at all. He was a lad from Strabane, which is you know a tough part of Northern Ireland, right on the border. And he was, you know, by all accounts, he could handle himself, and he could certainly handle himself on the pitch, and would just fly into tackles against opponents, and he would ride tackles, and he'd get kicked, and he'd dust himself down and carry on. But he had this sort of intellectual side to him really as well, and was writing poetry and writing stories, some of which are you know featured in the book. And he was he was just not your typical kind of one-dimensional footballer who thinks, right, I've just got to get through all of this, you know, all this kind of dressing room banter, all the kind of, well, bullying, for want of a better word.
Well, yes, let's face it.
But the homesickness as well. I mean, he really struggled with homesickness when he first went there. And he just thought, well, look, I'm not enjoying this. So...
Do you think there's more comparisons with George Best along those lines of maybe the personality wasn't quite fitting and George turned to drink to sort of cope with that? Whereas obviously Adrian turned to music a little bit.
Well, I think he turned to drink at times as well. No. I mean, he would have, if he was on a night out with his guitar, he'd be sinking a few pints of Guinness, that's for sure. But he was, for that, what was the recent George Best documentary? Was it called All Alone or
something?
It was really, really good. And the first half of that really reminded me of Adrian, where you just get the sense of this guy
just
who's
a little bit on the outside.
Yeah, and just how kind of fragile they feel when they're kind of dropped into this completely different environment, and you know the professional football environment. I mean, a lot of the guys who I spoke to said, look, it wasn't pleasant being a 16-year-old apprentice footballer in the late 80s, early 90s.
The Class of 92 documentary, like Nicky Butt, and that, they're all laughing about getting put in tumble dryers and stuff. They made it.
Yeah, yeah.
The people who didn't make it couldn't handle that. Yeah. That's probably something haunts them.
Yeah, and I got a big sense of that with a lot of the guys I spoke to, and they, you know, the guys who, I mean, I spoke to Paul Scholes for it, and he just said, look, it was just horrible. It was really horrible, and I didn't enjoy it at all, and you just had to live with it, and you know, you kind of tried to convince yourself it made you stronger. I think in some cases maybe it did toughen up players, but I'm sure in some cases it broke them. And there's a reason why all of that stuff doesn't happen now. It's because clubs realised it was completely inappropriate. And so when when the Class of 92 are talking about it and they're saying, yeah, well, it was grim, but you kind of look back with a laugh, and it was it made you stronger. yeah, maybe, but maybe it wouldn't have done you any harm not to go through it. Maybe there'll be others who
could have been just as good.
Didn't handle
that particular
thing. And there will be people who'd say, well, if you can't handle being chucked in a washing machine and tumble dryer, because it's different. Or if you can't handle the kind of cruel banter or kind of being, you know, having balls lashed at you it just seemed when I was researching the book, I just thought, God, how did all this kind of thing happen? And there'd be lookouts sort of standing outside the dressing room, and then Eric Harrison or Fergie would be coming down the stairs, and it would all stop. And it just sounds, considering what a kind of authoritarian, a control freak Ferguson was in a very good way, it's amazing how kind of what anarchy there was kind of going on in the dressing rooms.
I wonder if he fostered that to a certain extent, knowing that maybe he wanted a certain personality to come through. You don't.
Yeah, but I got the impression that there was a real fondness for him towards Adrian Doughty, and that he would have felt, you know, this guy needs an arm around him, and he needs, you know, we need to take him under our wing. And I think that kind of, as brutal as it sounds, as harsh as it sounds, I think that stopped by the time he got injured, and then he got, you know, his rehab wasn't going well, and he kind of went to New York to try and get signed up as a musician instead.
But that's happened to more footballers. Liam McClare, Brian McClare's son, quit United 6 or 7 years ago to be a musician. He was in the 18s at the time, doing really well.
Yeah.
I want to say he was in the same class as Pogba. It might have been the year before.
Yeah.
It's around that time.
But I would imagine any son of Brian McClare's would be a bright lad and would be maybe a more academic side. And I think he would probably have looked at the odds of making it from under 14s.
His dad was the academy director at the time as well. So.
And his dad would probably said, look, no offence.
Pretty good with that guitar,
mate. But I think that kind of more academic, intellectual kind of guy probably still even doesn't particularly thrive in that in the football dressing room environment, I'm sure it is a lot better now, and sort of the importance of education is emphasised, and there's great pastoral care, and that kind of thing didn't really exist back in those days. But I think what what Adrian Doughty had was other things in his life, which if he wasn't enjoying the football, which he certainly didn't after he got injured, and
well, you completely disappeared from the game, didn't
you? Yeah,
he didn't look back at all.
Yeah, well, he went. He got released by United in 1993, and just sort of, I mean, as Keith Gillespie said, it was like he just disappeared overnight. We never heard from him again, and he went to play. He initially went to live in Preston, supposedly because, fresh start, he put a pin in the map and thought, right, I moved to Preston. That was the kind of guy he was. Was working in a chocolate factory, and there was, he was offered the chance to move back home and play for Derry City in the League of Ireland, and he gave that a few games, and he just said, look, I've been at Man United. I didn't make it there. I don't want to spend the next 10 years sort of going on long bus journeys up and down Ireland playing for Derry City. The love for it had gone. His knee was sort of mangled, really, but I think he could still have had a good professional career.
What's crazy is that's such a almost routine injury now.
Yeah, yeah.
You'd be out for 6-7 months.
Well, even 5 years later, I don't think his cruise ship injury was handled well at the time by all accounts, and Giuliano Majorana, who's a guy who United fans of that generation will remember, he felt the same. But then I think by Paul Lake at Man City as well, within sort of 4 or 5 years, when 97 when Keane did his in 97, Shearer probably around the same time, and the expertise was so much greater. And
even Gazza, Gazza have a problem with his cruise ship.
Yeah, and that was 91 as well.
I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, he did it in the cup final in 91, and then he had, he never really recovered. He was a very good player after that, but he was never the same player. And I think Adrian probably just felt, you know, I'm kind of wasting my time here. I don't think he ever wanted to be an average footballer. I think he either wanted to be starting for Man United or nothing. Yeah, but people said, look, you know, you could be the next George Best, and I think he wanted to be the next Bob Dylan, which is it's cool.
Right, Ollie, thank you. This has been absolutely fantastic. So check the book out. Are we going to give one of these away? What do you reckon we do?
Yeah. We can give one away.
Should we just say a random commenter? We'll just let you pick a random comment.
Let me think. Yeah. No. You pick.
All right.
You pick one of the listeners at random.
What we'll do is retweet the pinned tweet on my Twitter, which will be this video once this has gone up, and just one of the people who've retweeted it. We'll give you one of these, and if you don't win it, I definitely recommend checking it out. Well, I really like the stuff that's, you know, you learn a little bit more about Eric Harrison, you learn a bit more about Fergie. Yeah. I like all of that sort of stuff because it's telling those stories while telling this story. And this is, it's like I said, it was one that you fell upon, but I'm glad you did.
No,
thanks. Thanks for joining us. And go and give Ollie a follow on Twitter and elsewhere. Who's next week? I can't remember. So subscribe, like, comment and all that sort of stuff. I'll see you in the next one. Laters.
Thank you.